It's no exaggeration to say that cars ruled that World's Fair. Detroit's Big Three worked very hard to grab the world's attention. We wanted to talk about what those messages were and how the Detroit Three weren't just selling cars. They were pushing a lifestyle and a political system.
People hardly know where to begin when they step into the world of the fair. It has something of everything, something for everyone.
Well, let's talk about the world of the fair as we're joined now by Joseph Tirella. His book is Tomorrowland, the 1964-65 World's Fair and the Transformation of America. Joseph, so good to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
As those gates swung open 50 years ago this day, we're wondering how much of the fair was dedicated to the Detroit Three and their exhibits?
Well, all three of them were there and had huge pavilions. In the 64 World's Fair is often talked about as all the corporate American pavilions that were there. But the big three were the three of the most popular. Cars were always central to the World's Fair, and all three exhibited at the previous New York World's Fair in 1939. And General Motors might have been carrying the biggest burden in that in 1939, they constructed the exhibit known as Futurama. And inside of that was the city of tomorrow and a vision of the world of tomorrow. So in 1964, they had this kind of legacy to live up to. Their plan right away was to do Futurama 2, which is to update this vision of the city of tomorrow. Again, because in 1939, the city of tomorrow that they showed was supposed to be America in 1960. Mm-hmm. So here we were in 1964, they had to kind of up the ante. So everyone was looking forward to that because the people who went to the first World's Fair, you know, remembered it as a kid, and they saw this vision in 1939 of skyscrapers and superhighways and cars. Now, I know it may not be a stretch of the imagination to think that General Motors would think the future of America included cars, but the future of America did include cars, so they were accurate in that way.
Well, we certainly saw as America got out of World War II and the Greatest Generation came home, and what did they do? They built the superhighways,
right.
And we saw
that
all through the 50s. And it is interesting, you think about it, how much we take cars for granted now. But give us a sense, if you can, Joe, how our parents and grandparents were thinking of cars and regarding cars in 1964 when the fair opened.
Well, by that time, everyone had a car, and a car really symbolized American freedom. I mean, you have to remember, this is 20 years. In 1964, it's 20 years after the end of the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
In 1939, they must have looked at that vision of that General Motors laid out and said, wow, because, I mean, this is the Great Depression's been going on for 10 years. You know, hadn't fully recovered in 1939, and then the war happens. The war ends, everyone comes home, and they start building suburbia, they start expanding, you know, outside of cities, and you need highways to get there. So they build the highway, international highway system. And then, some, you know, everyone needs cars, and Detroit is booming with cars, and the American car industry is the, you know, it's the envy of the world over. So now in 1964, the idea that it's kind of a given that you would need a car. Now, maybe people don't have two, three cars like they do today or whatever, but every family is going to have a car. So when you go to the 64 Fair, and at the Ford Pavilion, they debut the Ford Mustang. You know, nowadays we think of the Ford Mustang as kind of, you know, it's a cool car, maybe it's even borderline a muscle car,
right.
Something that, like, maybe guys would want to drive. But in 1964, when you see the picture of the fair, it was sold as a family car. Even the convertible. I mean, the Ford Pavilion, I mean, they were a brilliant piece of strategy. And maybe they thought, you know, we can't really compete with this Futurama stuff with General Motors. But what we're going to do is we're going to hire Walt Disney. We're going to get him to build us a ride. And then, since it's going to be long lines, and there were, we're going to put people in actual Ford Mustangs. And we're going to move them throughout the pavilion until you get to the ride on a conveyor belt. So everyone kind of has a test drive. And the whole family can sit in the car and be entertained by this Walt Disney ride.
And then using the genius of Walt Disney and his Imagineers, take a quick listen here.
Step into the wide world of Ford. This pavilion is a bridge between the past and the future.
So before we ever had Disney World in Orlando, so of course we had Disneyland out in California, but it really did give a much bigger chunk of Americans a chance to experience kind of that Disney magic and tie it in with the Mustang and with Ford.
That's why he got involved. Disney himself, Moses actually personally called on him.
And Moses being Robert Moses.
Robert Moses, the New York City master builder. He wanted Disney involved. And Moses was not one to share the spotlight, but he was all too happy to promote Walt Disney as one of the stars of his show.
Yeah.
But even before Moses contacted him, Disney had a meeting with all his top people. And he said, listen, they're building a World's Fair out in New York City. And all these corporations are going to throw millions of dollars, and then they're not going to know what the hell to do. So we're going to do it for them. And so all along he had this agenda that he wanted to get involved because he loved World's Fairs, and obviously he knew how to entertain people.
Yeah.
And he had no East Coast theme park yet. So he thought this would be a way to show people on the other side of the Mississippi who hadn't made it out to California in his park what Disney's form of entertainment's like, and actually used it as a testing ground. He also used all the money from corporations like Ford and Pepsi, who also he built a pavilion for, to, you know, to get his audio animatronics and all that technology that his Imagineers, as he called them, built.
And Chrysler's exhibit was a mini theme park?
Yeah, it was kind of a mini theme park that looked like a massive candy-colored car engine. Maybe that's the kindest way of putting it.
Okay.
It was, you know, at the time that the fair opened in 64, pop art was around. So when Chrysler opened, someone there had to have it in their mind. Like, they thought of it as this kind of like, you know, you see those when Madison Avenue kind of gets their got their hand on, like, the psychedelic 60s and
yes.
everything was, like, day-go colors.
Yes.
That's kind of what was happening. It's someone's idea of, like, hey, let's be cool, young, and hip, since we can't really compete with General Motors and we don't have a Ford Mustang or something like it. Let's have something just kind of outside the box. And we're going to have this big kind of mini theme park, this 80-foot massive engine. Of the big three pavilions, it's the one that looks like 1964.
I'm speaking with Joseph Tarella. His book is Tomorrowland, the 1964-65 World's Fair and the Transformation of America. And I want to circle back now to something we touched on at the beginning of our conversation, Joe, and that was General Motors looking into the future in the 1939 World's Fair, and then in 1964 decided to do it again with Futurama 2.
Right.
Welcome to Futurama 2. Welcome to a journey into the future. A journey for everyone today into the everywhere of tomorrow. Let us explore together the future. A future not of dreams, but of reality. It is now tomorrow.
What was GM's reality then? What was there tomorrow? It's here, it's now. What was that?
Part of it was this idea that in the future, I mean, they got this part right. They said that, you know, there would be missions to the moon, which obviously was already on the agenda, mm-hmm. and NASA was working on it. They said there'd be a space station, which, you know, it kind of looks like the space station we have now. But they have this idea, and this is really kind of Jetsons-like sci-fi fiction, that we would be living, or at least visiting underwater and staying in hotels, and that we can build housing underwater. And people would go down there and see, you know, live under the ocean, which, when you think about it, is probably, besides a far-fetched idea, it's probably a really bad idea. Considering how polluted the oceans are now, we can only imagine how polluted they would be if, like, say, 1 to 2 million people were living under the water.
Right.
And I think this is the part is what happens. And, you know, in 1939, everyone's looking towards tomorrow because
it was horrible. You know, it was the Depression.
Exactly. And the kind of economic prosperity that they were promising was around the corner, but it was going to be a long corner, right, after the war.
Yes.
In 64, that prosperity, people have been living with it for 20 years, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
So what could the future be? And already, you know, the government said, you know, President Kennedy said we should bring a man to the moon and bring him back safely to Earth. And NASA was in the middle of doing that. You're also at this weird moment where it's the space race. So although it's 1964 and no one's been to the moon yet, the idea that it's going to happen is there in everyone's mind.
Yeah.
It's almost like the future is imminent. So how does someone like GM, you want to look past that? You want to look down the line. What is the future? Since we're putting on, we're planning on putting a man on the moon in the next couple of years, what's going to happen 30 years from now, 40 years from now, 50 years from now? And I think that's maybe where they got into a little bit of trouble, because then you're just basically competing with Hollywood science fiction movies.
Yeah.
And we're not living underwater, and that's probably a good thing.
I think absent from all of these shiny visions was virtually any thought about the environmental or the social impact of cars.
Oh, yeah. Correct. That was not there at all. And I think that's another thing that represents the mindset of the fair in 64. People have been asking me, well, how come we don't do these things anymore? How come we don't have World's Fairs? And they do exist in other countries. But, you know, in 1964, you hit it on the head. People talking about cars. Cars represented freedom, highways, where we're going to live. We can build bigger. We can expand out to the moon. And no one's thinking at all about the environmental impact of anything. You know, let's live underwater. Let's build hotels. You know, we have a housing crisis. We'll put people underwater. I mean, that's getting into all sorts of potentially dangerous problems. How much electricity do you have to burn to make enough light so that you can, you know, light up the bottom of the ocean so people can see?
Nobody cared. And drive, drive, drive. It was, gas was, a you know, 10 cents a gallon.
No one cared in the least. That's the real difference
between
1964 America and now. There was no talk about the environmental impact of anything.
And knowing that at that point in 1964, there we were in the Cold War, we had a very wary eye on the Iron Curtain and what was on the other side, communism. So, you know, give us a sense of what that 1964 World's Fair and the Detroit 3 were trying to sell. It wasn't only cars.
No, I mean, all World's Fairs are trying to sell something.
Yeah,
the 64 World's Fair was trying to sell America as the beacon of, you know, democracy's light throughout the world. And that was also part of the problem, because even in during the Kennedy years, and President Kennedy was assassinated 5 months to the day before the fair opened, you know, one of the reasons why he came out with his civil rights bill on June 11th was to say, you know, he actually uses words like this. He said, you know, we promote democracy around the world and we mean it, but how are we going to do that if we sit here and say, you know, we have no second-class citizens, we have no master race in America, except, of course, for blacks? That's what he said. The fair, of course, was still promoting America and American corporations as just a force for good in the world. And yet, here we were, and there were protests and civil rights, you know, actions the first day of the World's Fair. President Johnson came to the World's Fair. They gave a speech, and he was shouted down by 200 college activists who were saying, you know, we have a World's Fair, but we don't have a fair world, and that sort of thing. You know, the shininess and the hope of the World's Fair, peace through understanding, was a wonderful idea, but it didn't really jive with what was happening in the country.
And as you write in your book, that fair in 1964-65 marked the beginning of the end of an era in American history. So we were saying goodbye to things without even knowing it at the time, weren't we?
That's right. People did not know that this was the end. They thought it was a new beginning. And instead, it was the end of that post-war period, the end of kind of the black and white Eisenhower years, or even the black and white of the so-called Camelot Kennedy years, and we were going full force into the Technicolor of the 1960s, and I don't think people really knew that. I mean, writing the book and researching the early parts of the 1960s, the whole political history, there was a lot going on. And the fair itself, which is why I wrote the book, is kind of overshadowed between the early part of the 60s and then what happens later. Because what happens later is, you know, peace and drugs and sex and rock and roll and Woodstock and
Vietnam,
lots of assassinations and Vietnam and race riots, you know, stuff that you could really see. The thing about the 60s is you can see it. You know, you can actually see Bobby Kennedy dying on film. You can see what Vietnam must have been like, at least a little bit, for some of the troops, because you can see the footage. You can see Woodstock. You can see all these people in the shows. You can see the race riots. Whereas it's kind of harder to, like, well, how do you show the fear people felt in the Cold War? You know, that's a little harder. A lot of what happened after the fair, it's all captured on television. And that's probably why it was maybe more the focus of the decade as opposed to some of the other parts.
Joseph Terrella, his book is Tomorrowland, the 1964-65 World's Fair and the Transformation of America. Very fun to talk to you, Joseph. Thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Great. It's great to be here. Thank you very much.